Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Ivy Unfiltered. It's Barry and Vidal again, and we're excited for another week with you.
Welcome back everybody. We're going to be talking about how to move fast and fix things. We're going to be talking about raising our energy levels, how to get the most out of our heads and our hearts. Going to get key lessons from billionaires and how we can supercharge our content marketing. So it's going to be a jam-packed hour together. And to get us started, we'll focus on the interview we just did with Francis Fry and Ann Morris, where they took Mark Zuckerberg's phrase of move fast and break things and turned it into how to move fast and fix things. So my key takeaway from this incredible conversation with Francis and Ann was the fact that if we want to make any kind of a change in our organizations, we should be asking a very simple question. What will add a zero to our top line? So what will 10x our performance from in terms of revenues, while also doubling the sentiment within our teams? So imagine of all the initiatives, all the critical areas that you may need to be focusing on in your organization, which few could make that kind of a difference, not only massively increase the growth of the business, but also double the sentiment, the experience of employees being there. So they've created this new framework where you could take a week and make this kind of change happen. The key takeaway for me was that often we're all so busy performing and doing all the things and trying to hit all the different KPIs that even when we're aware that there's significant blockers for growing the business or how we collaborate as a team or how we take care of ourselves, we just look to power through. And the advice from Francis and Anne, as well as everything we do at Ivy that I've seen firsthand, is that if a container is created, if time and space is created, whether that's 60 minutes or whether that's a week, like Francis and Anne talks about, first and foremost, there's got to be a container to specifically remove blockers. Does your organization have time and space created just to remove the blockers without talking about every other aspect of the business? Secondly, when such a container is created, we got to remove any blockers to people getting along within that container. So anything that will maximize trust, maximize creativity, and minimize, you know, heightened emotions that can be quite negative. How we've put this into action is what we do with Ivy. Based on all the organizations we work with and their key priorities, we create these monthly 60 to 90 minute spaces where together with the whole team, whether that's the exec team or the team more broadly, we talk about all the ways in which we can learn from a thought leader, we can then apply those learnings, and then commit to a particular kind of change. So even though everyone is super busy, in just 60 to 90 minutes, everybody gets clarity on, wow, okay, what's the one tweak I can make that can make all the difference? So that really resonated with me, and all the other modules in the podcast this week is going to be touching on how to better fill those containers and how to better create those containers in the first place. Vidal, what about you? What resonated most with you when it came to this module?
First, I just have to start with this, with the title of the module or the title of their book as well, and the framework, Move Fast and Fix Things. I almost said break things there because I'm so conditioned to think in that way. But I just love this approach. And I think it, in so few words, you can get across so much meaning. And I think certainly the bulk of my career has been within a move fast and break things mentality and mindset. The constraints that we had, particularly in my work at Cano, were very much, we were moving fast. We wanted to break things, but we had all these external constraints put on us. And we just wanted to be free. And we were so yearning for that freedom to break things. But now having been through that experience and looking at it from the other side, I think about the reality is moving fast, yeah, it feels good. But breaking things, it has its costs. At the time, it feels liberating. But you have to deal with the weight and the baggage of those things that you've broken later down the line, which does lead to severe morale problems. So the big takeaway for me from this module was how easy it is for organizations. I suppose for some organizations, they don't even address the symptoms. They're not really focused on the problems. Just move forward. Bulldoze as much as you can and see where you end up, right? It's just like one huge gamble in my view. It's not particularly thoughtful. It's just like hope for the best and hope somebody cleans up. And I always found myself in roles where I'm the one kind of mopping and sweeping up. But I think what Francis and Anne have done here is they specifically call out the need to focus on root causes and not symptoms. Because the reality is that fixing and addressing symptoms doesn't make the problems go away. And you need to create those containers and you need to create that space to actually find the root causes, because it's not obvious. You need to ask again. You need to ask again. And this is something I've learned from you. Anytime we're having a conversation about something, we think, okay, we've gotten to the bottom of this one, or we've talked about this enough. You always say, let's talk about it for another 15 minutes, because every time we have the instinct of saying, okay, we're done, that's actually the time where we're really not done. We need to put 15 more minutes into it. So the way that we do with all of our clients, building that 90 minutes of space, a lot of that work is about finding root causes, and not only root causes of problems, by the way, it's also more focused on finding root causes of success. Because really identifying the root cause of your positive outcomes is equally as important, if not more important, than finding the root causes of your problems. And yeah, I'm really happy that Francis and Anne with this framework have made it such that they're not telling you to slow down. They're just telling you to create space. And they're actually encouraging people to do this really fast, literally in a week. They go Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. That's the week. And there's like an activity to be done in each of the days of the week. They say the chances of failure of an initiative, if you're thinking of it in monthly timescales or yearly, it's more likely to fail. And doing it fast is important, and addressing these root causes and identifying and addressing these root causes is extremely important in a short period of time. It doesn't have to be painful. It doesn't have to be this long drawn out process that's going to burn people out. So I found it extremely refreshing. I found it also encouraging, because it does dovetail very well with the work that we do with organizations and with our methodology, which is always encouraging. And it's a validation of, we see the impact that we make on organizations, and we're constantly trying to improve ourselves as well in the work that we do. And it's so refreshing that we get to learn from thought leaders like Anne and Francis. And in Francis's case, we've already learned so much from her and applied so much for her. So it's very refreshing that we get to continue doing that and continually improve what we're doing with the latest frameworks from the best thought leaders.
Yeah, exactly. So very specifically, the framework that Francis and Anne share is that in the space of a week, on the Monday, you just focus on defining what is the real problem, the root cause blocker, obstacle that, if solved, could 10x the business and double the sentiment. On Tuesday is where, as the leadership team, you have to come up with like as many potential solutions as possible. And by the end of Tuesday, have some kind of a draft plan. On Wednesday, you pull in other people who are not in the leadership team to kick the tires on that and refine the approach. On Thursday, it's all about then creating a narrative and a storytelling around the plan that's going to really galvanize people. And then on Friday, you just get going with it. So a lot of companies have typically 1 to 3 day offsites, something like that. And I do believe that this could easily fit into essentially in a 2 day offsite. It could be defining the problem first day, coming up with a plan in the second day, and then the retreat could be over for in terms of full time, or it could continue. But in any case, on the third day, if it's socialized, and on the fourth day, a narrative is created, and the fifth day it can be executed, it can be really huge. I also asked them about, what if people get distracted after these few days of intense work? What if they then just get back to business as usual? Their response was, well, if you came up with something that will 10x the business and double the sentiment, believe me, people are not going to get distracted. They're going to go with it. The danger that I see based on our experiences, and which will help us segue to the second module we're going to be covering today, is that even when time and space is created and when there is a really good system in place, let's say it's the one that Francis and Anne recommend, people can still fail to communicate effectively, and they could get very frustrated or checked out and so forth. So it's going to be critical also in those occasions to really ensure that the approach is refined and people are interacting in a way that brings out the best results. So that brings me to our second module from this week, which is called Energy Rising: The Neuroscience of Leading with Emotional Power by Dr. Julia DeGangi. And she had some powerful insights. Most importantly, though, is that our brains are a pattern detector. Emotions are what give us energy. And we need to recognize that even before we had language with words, we had the emotions that we felt. So it's our primal language, and how we manage those emotions plays a critical role. And as leaders, we need to always remember that in addition to all the things we need to do that's on our to-do list, regulating the energy of ourselves and therefore our teams is a really critical part, which then comes down to emotional regulation, which most business leaders don't typically get trained on. When you study business, this is more like psychology or neuroscience, right? But we know anyone with any leadership role knows that emotions play such a key role, but they feel like the loosey-goosey stuff compared to the OKRs and the KPIs and things like this. When I was interviewing her, the key thing that came back to me was she basically said, well, if someone is triggering you all the time and annoying you, maybe the problem is with them. But if you're getting triggered by everyone in your company, then most likely the problem is with you. So really the key is to look for patterns. So what are the recurring negative patterns in our minds and within our teams? And I thought back to earlier days at Ivy, where we would have these MC management committee meetings. And every single, even though I had great people on the team with me, and I really greatly appreciated them at an individual level and the great work they did, these meetings were always a bit of a disaster. They were so frustrating all the time. Whenever we sat around the table, like, it would just get so negative. I would feel like I would be presenting solutions and people would just be negative mostly. And I don't know, it was just like so, so negative. I was lucky enough to meet an amazing fellow founder in New York City, who we also interviewed, Isaac Oates. I shared with him this kind of dilemma, and he taught me a process called the washing machine, a different approach to leading meetings. And essentially what it involves is, if you're the person presenting an idea or a finding or an initiative or some need to change in a meeting, you present, then you shut your mouth, and you let everyone else in the room ask clarifying questions. And you don't say, oh, does anyone have any question? You say, I want to hear from each person, what is your clarifying question? And then once everybody asks their clarifying questions, you don't answer any of them until everyone has asked. You have to write them down. Then you answer and clarify the questions. Once the clarifying questions have been answered, then everybody goes around and says, okay, based on what was presented, this is what I loved, and this is what was missing. And each person just shares up for a minute, and they know they have to share it. So it's not optional. So even when they're listening, they know that they're going to have to share what they loved and what they thought was missing. And because once we started implementing it, because I knew I couldn't speak until everyone had expressed themselves, my energy level, my emotions were not as triggered, because I wasn't jumping in and saying something in response, which was like increasing the temperature in the room. And everybody had to listen to each other. Everybody got a word in. And it felt much more like we were together trying to get what I presented to be better, as opposed to being adversaries on how can we better do something. So the way the washing machine works is presenter presents, everybody asks clarifying questions. Clarifying questions are answered all at once. Then everybody shares what they loved and what they thought was missing. Then the person who presents it gets to respond to what was said and share their thinking. And then everybody says again what they love about what was clarified and what's still missing without the person presenting interrupting. And you do that until no one has anything left to say. And it's an incredibly powerful structure, even in social settings. Whenever someone says something, if you can be the kind of person that's okay, before everybody dives in and like starts like, because the loudest voices typically dominate, it's usually the same people. But if there's a bit of a regulation whereby we say, hey, okay, let's hear from everyone just for a quick minute, what you think about what was said, everybody gets to hear from each other. You get a much better understanding of where people stand, and it feels more of a collaborative situation. A lot of the ego stuff also disappears a little bit because everyone is getting time and space to make their point. So not only is time and space created, a container created for the whole conversation, but a mini container is created for each person, so they don't have to fight to have that container. And they can also just sit back and relax while everybody else does the talking and performing. So it's a bit of a positive trap in creating containers for everyone. They have to express themselves, and then the back and forth follows. So when I interviewed Julia, I realized, wow, okay, now I get it. That's why the washing machine process is so effective, because it gets people to create containers and mini containers within the conversation, and leads to much better energetic exchanges as well, because emotions just get contained also within those containers, rather than with no limits, people can just get really annoyed or really excited. In any case, shutting other people off from the conversation. What about you, Vidal? What came up for you?
I want to react to everything that you just said first. It's super powerful to me, and I've experienced this. I don't think since I've joined Ivy, we've been calling it the washing machine, but it is, that is practically how we do many of our team meetings. And the equal airtime is so powerful. And I think there's a conditioning in many organizations that the loudest speakers contribute the most, but everyone has something to contribute. And we both know that aggregated wisdom often comes to the best result, and everyone is in the room and at that table for a reason. So I was very happy, and we've definitely talked about this before, during COVID, when meetings started happening on Zoom, all of a sudden, a lot of power dynamics shifted because everyone was the same size box on the Zoom gallery view. And it made it a bit easier for everyone to participate, because energetically speaking, we talked about last week about gravitas, usually those people with higher gravitas, they find it easier in person to dominate the conversation. But structurally creating space is so important, so powerful. But also what I was going to say, it's not about just giving equal airtime. It's about also, it creates a pressure, and I think a very positive pressure, and a very positive forcing mechanism for everyone sitting at that table to know, well, I have a responsibility, I have a duty to contribute here. I can't just sit in the back seat. And often I think when environments are created where people are okay with sitting in the back seat, because they, and it can be from a very legitimate and credible thought that no one really cares what I think anyway. So they get into this space where they're not particularly concerned. I think what that leads to is I'm going to bring up a quote from the previous module that we discussed with Francis Fry and Anne Morris, which is that burnout, this is a quote directly from Anne, burnout is essentially exhausted mediocrity that deeply affects individuals and their work experiences. So once again, burnout is essentially exhausted mediocrity that deeply affects individuals and their work experiences. Now, burnout, such an interesting concept. I want to talk about it and just do a bit of an experience share, because energy is so important, and the energy of leadership is particularly important for the rest of the team. We talked about it last week about this concept of organizational anxiety, how the energy levels, and this is what Julia talks about as well, the energy levels of leadership massively impact the energy levels of the entire team and organization around them, including the aggregated team. So I, as a person who I would say was skeptical about the concept of burnout, because I had a bit of a rah-rah, I'm super strong, I work crazy hard, and I'm fine about it. And I was really proud. It was like this point of pride. I had this concept. I wanted to hear about burnout, other people talking about burnout. I'd be quite dismissive. 2-3 years later, it's not a long time ago, I feel quite bad, honestly. Whatever the opposite of vindicated is, that's what I feel. I was completely wrong. And I learned that I was wrong because I experienced burnout, and I experienced how difficult that is. And it's a whole body experience. It's not just about, it's not a mental burnout. It's also a physical burnout, and the combination of the two. So I realized I was burnt out when I, all of a sudden, on the way to a football or soccer for our American listeners match on the train here in London, I found myself on the floor of that train out of nowhere, and a bunch of people trying to wake me up. I fainted. That was a particularly hard week that I was working on. And after that, I had 2 weeks. I was dizzy. I couldn't work. And I didn't really get back to normal after that. I just couldn't recover, actually, until in the end, like a year or more later. So extremely difficult, but an important learning exercise for me. And it just made me realize, as I was just reflecting in this module, that understanding the impact that you have as a leader, so I'm speaking to leaders now, understanding the impact that your energy levels have on everyone around you is so crucial for success. And as you said, Barry, sometimes if one person is annoying you, they might be the problem. But if everyone's annoying you, then you may be the problem. And that means like there's something energetically off with you. And it's so important to realize that emotions are not just thoughts. And emotions are not just these feelings. This is science. Emotions are hormones. Emotions are biochemistry in our bodies. And we have to create time and space to focus on maximizing our emotions, maximizing our energy levels, and regulating them as well. Because it's not always, you don't always have to be high energy, but you have to be very aware of when you're low energy and behave differently. So it's okay to have low energy days. And it doesn't mean you have to pretend and put on an act, because that can be also very draining on your own energy. And human beings are smart. They can see through it as well, generally. No one's that good an actor. But understanding your highs and lows, regulating your highs and lows, and understanding what behaviors bring the best out of you in those highs and lows, I think is super important. And it's since I've had that burnout experience, it's something that I've been deeply working on with myself and really reflecting on. So even this morning, I texted you, right? Like I said, today's different. My energy level is different today. Now it's a Sunday, we're recording the podcast, it's all good. But if it were Monday today, it doesn't mean, oh, I'm going to check out, it's a bad day. But it does mean, okay, I need to approach this day a little bit differently. And I need to think about, is there a group meeting that maybe is better that I move to the next day? Not to run away from it, but just to make sure that I can bring my best self. Because there is a cost of powering through. All of that to say, just to bring it full circle, if burnout is this exhausted mediocrity, it's not because it's the individuals involved want to be mediocre. That's not what it's about. It's really about the combined energy of each individual and all of them as an aggregate coming together to create a more powerful force. And energy can be both a positive and a negative force. And we as leaders need to be very deliberate, cognizant, and aware of what kind of energy we're putting out, what kind of energy we're taking in, and ensuring that aggregated energy is maximized to positive effect. And just final point, coming back to Anne and Francis, the concept of setting that kind of 10x goal, 10x objective, and doing it in a short period of time effectively pushes energy forward in my views. It's a forcing mechanism because it's hard to not be excited about a 10x goal. But it is relatively easy to not be excited, be dejected, be cynical about a 1.1x goal. Nobody wakes up and they think, oh my God, we're gonna get like 10% efficiency gain. No, they want to find 100% efficiency gain, 1,000% efficiency gain. They want to find 1,000% impact, because that's exciting and that feeds energy. So, well, I love this module. I love the concept of energy. I think it's extremely important, and I'm really happy it's being talked about more. And it's a recurring theme in this week's modules, and I think it is really a recurring theme every week now. Looking at the latest books and frameworks being published, and I think every week we have more and more discussion of energy levels and how important it is to leadership. So I'm glad we're bringing that out, and I'm glad everybody's talking about it now.
Yeah. One thing you talked about around waking up a particular way in a given day and knowing where your energy is, just want to use that as a segue to the Chris Allman module, where he talked about how, so Chris Allman is the communications director for many years for David Rubenstein, co-founder of Carlyle Group, incredible individual who's also the chairman of the board of the Kennedy Center, the Smithsonian, the Council on Foreign Affairs. So amazing billionaire. And there's three other billionaires at Carlyle. Chris Allman wrote a book called The Four Billionaires and the Parking Attendant. And he talked about how every day that Chris would drive into Carlyle, into the like deep basement where the parking garage was, there was an Ethiopian origin parking attendant, Saleh, who every day would greet him with the biggest smile, ask him how his day is going, wish him a great day, and just cheer him up so much. And then Chris would walk into the elevator, take the lift up to the main floor, and then bump into all these incredibly successful business people, including the four billionaires in question. And often he was shocked by the difference between how happy, upbeat, and galvanizing and inspired Saleh was compared to how these super successful business people were often not like that. And essentially what Chris made the point around was that you can also choose how you want to be, how you want to come across. We all have countless blessings and miracles in our lives, and we also have countless challenges and obstacles and unfulfilled dreams in our lives. And sometimes wherever we focus can basically then impact what our body's registering. So a while back, we had a module with Dan Tomasulo, who leads the Spirit Mind Body Institute at Columbia University, one of the pioneers of positive psychology with Martin Seligman. And he also talks a lot about the fact that the neurochemistry of the brain is such that if you imagine a lemon that doesn't exist, if you close your eyes and hold the imaginary lemon in your hand, and then you've like bite into it and like just chew the lemon, your mouth will literally create saliva. You will feel the bitterness and the tartness of the lemon, and there's no lemon. And he says, that's exactly, your brain cannot tell between what's real and what's imagined. And and Jim Quick says, wherever your attention goes, that's where your energy flows. When I listened to Chris Allman about this parking attendant, Saleh, it just made me realize, wow, because that guy's so upbeat, if he greets everyone at Carlisle in that way and just nudges them in a bit more of a positive direction every day, the chain reaction of that is incredible. Whereas if Saleh was rude and unhappy and depressed and acted that way for being down there, not only would he probably feel worse, but also everybody he would interact with would feel worse also. It's actually really moving when I remembered Dante Masullo's lesson based on the story of Saleh, because it puts actually a lot of, in a way, it's very powerful and positive because it means we have agency, so that no matter what's going on, by choosing to focus on what we're grateful for, what we have to be happy about, versus choosing to focus on what sucks and what's blocking us, it gives us some agency. But also it can be quite depressing to think about that, because then if I think back on the last week with so many incredible things that happened, but did I feel 10 out of 10 happy the whole time? No, I didn't. I was actually quite stressed out. And it just made me realize, wow, maybe I'm really screwing up the journey for myself. Because no matter, and the world has plenty of negativity always, but it does behoove us, I would say, to also then be really mindful about choosing to be happy. And this isn't just so we feel good and things are great, but if we're leaders, it's going to impact everyone around us like crazy. And it's going to have a huge impact also on our business performance and growth, not just because of the team, but how we come across to clients or prospects or other stakeholders. So leadership is tough. It's like, for everybody, it's important to be happy and grateful and bring your best to the world. But then as a leader, not only do you sabotage yourself if you fail to do that, but you also sabotage everyone around you. So it's almost like an obligation to be joyous. And that's not in any job description for leadership that I've seen so far. But certainly we know it when we see it, a leader that lifts us up and gets us to see the light, and their energy is contagious and lifts us up, versus leaders who cause us to crash and burn because they're in such a terrible state that we get dragged down too. And I want to just say, I imagine that on a spectrum of negativity to positivity, I'm pretty positive. I'm quite like most people would rank me quite high. But I would rank myself these days maybe 5 or 6 out of 10 compared to what I'm capable of in terms of the positive energy I could bring. And I find it easier socially, but when it's business, also when it's business and it's internal, I find it the hardest. When it's business and external, it's easier. And when it's purely social, it's the easiest. So I definitely need to level up my game, because even if we could create the containers, and even if we create structures like the washing machine, if we ourselves are not, or create a container like this podcast, if we're not at our positive, grateful mindset, we're just not going to be like that. People can pick up on the energy. It doesn't mean it's bad, but certainly it's not as good as Saleh, the parking attendant, lifting somebody like Chris Allman up every single day of his career and leading them to have a better day. So that's what came up for me on that one. Vidal, what do you think?
Wow, beautifully said. I will attest that you're certainly the most optimistic and positive person that I know. But I think I also really respect that you only rank yourself 5 or 6, because the reality is you can always do better on all of these metrics and do better for everyone around you. I want to echo a couple of things that you said. First of all, I think there's this line of thinking, which Chris does such a great job of pushing back against. There's this line of thinking that constant joy or sustained joy is somehow naive or ignorant, or it's ignorance is bliss kind of thing. And open your eyes. See, there are people, cynical people in the world who are like, no, open your eyes. Things are bad. Don't be joyous, right? And those are, I consider, extremely selfish people. To me, and you use the word obligation, it's not just for leaders. It's for all human beings. Any human being that interacts with other human beings, being happy, being joyous, it's your duty to others. It's probably the greatest favor that you can do for everyone. And we talked about this, I think last week or the week before, that negativity is easier. It's less energy draining in a weird way. choosing joy, and I choose joy is another one of my mantras that I repeat a lot that I try to live up to, but it's a conscious choice. Choosing joy is much more difficult, particularly on hard days, right? We all have our problems. So choosing joy and like bringing that to the forefront of your emotional energy is difficult. And so it's easy to not choose joy. And so living up to that obligation and that duty, it's not naive. It's quite the opposite. It's extremely wise. And I'm going to bring this together with just a very simple personal anecdote, which I really love. And this is one of the anecdotes I share with many people. Back when I lived in Nepal, and for those listening, after high school, before starting college, I lived in Nepal for a year and did a variety of different projects. One of the projects I worked on was I worked with an incredible group of Nepalis that would bring foreign school groups, teenagers, 16, 17 year olds to Nepal, pair them with a local community. And we'd organize different activities and learning experiences for them and pair them with communities. And the idea was that these schools would come back every single year, so it would be a sustained relationship. On one of these trips, a group came from Istanbul, and we always encouraged the students coming to bring little gifts and so on for the, usually we paired them with a primary school. We encouraged them to bring little gifts and so on. In one of these trips, in a town called Bandipur, in a very dilapidated school building, there's a picture of me in that classroom looking very depressed because I was shocked the first time I saw it. These students from Istanbul brought a ball and these two boys were playing with the ball. They're playing football. They're just kicking it around. And one of them kicked the ball. Nepal is very mountainous for those that don't know. One of the boys kicked the ball off basically a cliffside. Ball was gone, unrecoverable at that point. I'm sure someone could have gone and retrieved it at that point, but basically unrecoverable. And these boys, they just didn't even miss a beat. They just continued playing. They like found something else to play with, and they just continued playing, smiling. And the kid who had brought the ball asked one of the teachers, one of the local teachers, he was like, "What just happened there? It's like they didn't even register that they lost the ball. They're just as happy. Why aren't they upset?" And the teacher said, "They didn't have a ball to begin with. So what is there to be upset about? They were happy for the time that they had the ball." For me, this encapsulates the true wisdom of what choosing joy means. And those two boys, I don't think it's not necessarily a conscious decision that they made there. But for me, it's a perfect encapsulation of what choosing joy really means, because it's all about what you focus on. They focused on the time where they had the ball and then they moved on. They don't think about when they lost the ball. And I think that's really the parking attendant. He focused on the privilege of his work and what he got to do and the people he got to interact with every day. Maybe the four billionaires upstairs, with everything that they could choose and look at to be joyous from, they were focused on where they didn't hit their numbers or what they couldn't achieve or what they need to do. And they were not living up in many ways. Maybe they were obviously extremely successful. So they lived up to expectations in many ways and surpassed expectations in many ways. But there's just also the simple act of having the wisdom to choose joy and see and find joy in every situation. So that's a little anecdote that I really love and I always bring up. And I'm going to give a big shout out to Nepalis in general, because despite being one of the poorest countries on earth, it is by far the most joyous cultures and people that I've ever experienced. And it's very hard not to feel also joyous there, even though what can feel very depressing a lot of the time doesn't come across from the people that you interact with at all. So I find that very powerful.
Fantastic story. What a reminder. How many times have we lost the metaphorical ball and then whined about it and forgot to keep playing and all the other things that were still going for us? So really great reminder. One final module that is continuing us on this journey that we've been talking about today around creating the container, bringing our best to the container, making sure others bring their best to the container. Obviously, what we just talked about, choosing happiness, was key. The other module we shared this week was with Kirsten Ferguson called Head and Heart, The Art of Modern Leadership. So essentially, Kirsten breaks down these critical ways to lead more effectively and divides it into the head and the heart. So under the head, she says curiosity, wisdom, perspective, and capability. Those are the key drivers of how to better use our own heads. And she says these ones are easier compared to the heart, which includes humility, courage, leading with empathy, and self-awareness. So we need both of these things. Sometimes we overweight some of these factors at the expense of some others, and having harmony and balance is critical. Of all these factors, though, Kirsten said, perspective, reading a room, figuring out who is maybe missing in the room or what's not getting said, not just verbal cues, but the whole emotional language, the body language, and what's going on in there. That's one of the most critical aspects of leadership. And it's almost at this point where it reminded me of that kind of skill is like, how would you even teach someone be more aware of what's happening in the room? Like, you're either picking things up or you're not. So part of me thought that's muscle memory. If you've been in a million meetings, you can probably notice a lot more patterns than if you've only been in 10 meetings in your life, right? So some of it is just muscle memory. But some of it, I think, is, again, creating containers, creating spaces. So if, for example, you do the washing machine process, then you can't help but be aware of what people are thinking because you're making them say, what do you love about it? What do you not like about it? Mm. So I thought that was a really critical one. However, even if we do all of that, there's still a danger, which is, sure, you could be aware at this level, but then there's a deeper level and a deeper level and a deeper level still and a deeper. And at some point, there's a root cause blocker, root cause obstacle. And the question is, how far do we let ourselves go? Now, in a lot of creativity and innovation-based modules we've done, people always say that the most creative, most innovative people, they generate the most number of ideas. It's not about the quality, it's the quantity. Let's say you're brainstorming a solution and your team comes up with 10 possible solutions. And then you're like, okay, out of these 10, now let's pick the best three, let's pick the best one, let's execute. But actually, if you just took another hour and generated 20 or 30 or 40 solutions, it's quite possible the 38th one is the best one and you will have missed out on that. But it's contrary to human nature sometimes to just keep thinking about what else and what else. When we have so much in front of us, we just want to get to work. We want to take actions. Kirsten reminded us of the 5 whys, which I believe was popularized by Toyota, which is essentially whether it's talking to a customer and figuring out what's wrong with them or with a colleague or as a team when we're diving into something that's blocking us, asking, why is that happening? And then asking again and again and again, 5 times until there's no further place to go to really get to that root cause. And she says, obviously, it could be annoying if you just said why like a kid, but you can put it in smoother ways. Help me understand a little more about what's behind that. Tell me how, guide us on what more we should know about the root cause of this, or even tell me more, say more about that. Gets people to just say more and more. At Ivy, we call this the first step of everything is the diagnostic. To really understanding based on where someone is and where they want to get to, what are the critical things blocking them? And then, but what's really blocking them? Oh, well, what's behind that? And really trying to get to the bottom of it. And then only then taking time to come up with potential solutions and ideally as many as possible before picking the best solutions and executing from there. So I thought for perspective taking, given that she said that's the most important, head and the heart, like being able to have that perspective and read the room being so critical, how much of a crazy on goal would it be if, one, we don't even create the room in the first place, so we have no idea what people are thinking because we never decided to address something. And then if you've already created the room, what an on goal it is if we don't give people the chance to express themselves. And even when they do, that we don't really, as a leader, push to get to the root cause and get all our people in a mindset of asking the 5 whys as well. So imagine 2 teams, equal resources, equal intelligence, equal capital, equal everything, but one that asks the 5 whys and creates the spaces to remove obstacles. And the other one is just like too busy executing all the time to get there. I know which one I would bet for. I thought it was a powerful underlining of how important it is to get this right as a leader. What did you think of this one, Bede?
Very interesting. It's making me reflect on the concept of awareness, right? So reading the room, as you said, some people just have that superpower. They just have super high EQ and they just can see and read all those little nonverbal cues, body language, even verbal cues and everything else. They can hear the emotion in people's voices. And that's great. If you have those natural talents, that's fantastic. I think in literally every single episode of this podcast so far, we've talked about the concept of deliberate practice. And so first of all, if you have that natural talent, I would encourage you to work on it, because you can definitely get better. Don't over-index on your natural talents. But what's important is, if you don't have that natural talent, the five whys, that's the secret, right? All you need to do to become more aware is to ask, right? It seems so simple, but we often don't do it. If it's not immediately obvious to us, it's awkward to ask questions. It's certainly awkward to ask follow-up questions like a third time and a fourth time. I've heard you say it many times, Barry, in these diagnostic processes. You say, okay, I understand, but what's truly the root cause? Like, you go a bit deeper. But it's good, because the real truths come out there. And probably if you did 30 iterations of that, you do get much and much, much closer. You're reaching some kind of asymptote there, but there's diminishing returns. However, you're getting something closer to the truth. And the reality is, the more you ask these questions, the more aware you're going to be. So there is a practice to this, because you're just gathering information at that point. But you don't have to rely on this kind of like spidey senses that you may or may not have. So asking questions is so important. She also highlights self-awareness as being super important. So external awareness is extremely important, awareness of everyone around you. Self-awareness is also, I think, often overlooked. And I've mentioned that I've worked a lot on self-awareness, particularly recently. And the reality with self-awareness is, you have to ask yourself the same questions too. And you have to be quite deliberate about that as well, because it's really easy to ignore. It's very easy to just let your emotions answer the questions for you, and never figure out, no, what's the root cause? What is the root cause, as Julia would say, behind your negative energy? Or for Anne and Francis would also say, within an organization, don't look at the symptoms, look at the root causes. You have to ask questions within yourself as well, because you're certainly an agent in that process. I find that all super fascinating. I also think it's extremely challenging and shouldn't be taken for granted, but I want people to take away the fact, because I'm taking this away, it's about being deliberate. It's not about just having the talent or being like, I'm either have high EQ or not. You can get better at this. This is something that can also be practiced. And speaking about self-awareness, it's one of my favorite quotes, which I don't fully remember. The quote basically goes like this: man in full knowledge of himself is a supreme creature of creation. I believe that was said by a priest, and I think they were referring to creation being God's creation. However, I always took it to be a supreme creature of creation, i.e. a creative being. And self-awareness and external awareness are so crucial to creating something new, to creating innovation within groups and as an individual as well. I encourage everyone to try to become in full knowledge of themselves, but also in full knowledge of everyone that they interact with. But you can only do that by asking them questions. It's not going to happen otherwise. You're going to scratch the surface of information without asking those questions. And finally, I'll bring up my favorite character. I talked about Da Vinci because for the first few episodes of this podcast, I was reading Walter Isaacson's Leonardo da Vinci biography, which I highly recommend. And Da Vinci was a master of observation, and he has immense natural talents, but he asked questions, and in his notebooks, there are thousands of questions and notes to himself, figure out why that happens. Why is this like this? Why is that like that? And then he would come back to those questions and be curious about those questions. And that curiosity really fueled his greatness in art, in science, and in everything that he did. And he asked questions of people as well to understand their motivations, because it was important to him when painting a subject. He needed to know what state they were in, and he wanted to reflect their emotional state within the static two-dimensional or pseudo three-dimensional image that he was creating, so there could be some level of motion and energy. The five whys, there are five whys, there could be 25 whys as well. And there's probably not a limit, but you're going to get close to the truth the more that you ask. If you just look, the number pi is 3.14, but you get closer and closer to the truth the more you go down the digits when reflecting on that number.
Excellent. So with those insights in mind, we'll move to our final module for this week. We talked a lot about creating containers and communication and bringing the best out of people and asking the whys. A lot of today was about internally how we do all these things and remove the blockers. The final module we have is really focused on how we can supercharge our content marketing by harnessing the power of our brand's voice. So for everybody in our audience, how do we also not create these containers just internally within our organization to remove blockers, but how can we also create external containers to supplement the products and services we already deliver in the context of content marketing? So one key insight from Robert Rose is that it's really important in our companies, if we're going to do any kind of external content marketing, is to really think and operate much more like a media company. Doesn't matter what our products and services are. When it comes to content marketing, really figuring out this overarching strategy like a media company, what are we producing, with what frequency, and what does good enough look like, and how are we going to experiment, what's the cadence, and so forth. It's very powerful. And at Ivy, over time, we went from hosting one digital event a month to one a week, and then 12 a month, and now we're at 20 a month, one every working day. And at some point, we made decisions on who are we going to invite for those interviews, how are we going to conduct interviews, what are we going to do with those interviews. So it's been a multi-year process of figuring that out. It's certainly not easy, but having been through it and hearing what Robert had to share in this module, I remember a conversation I had with our colleague Olivia. I was in Chicago to host some events. She was in New York at the time. We were on the call and she asked me like, okay, but are we just inviting whoever is interesting? What's our whole thing here? Like, how do we decide who to invite or not? So these decisions can be faster. Because before we would just like think about every single person. Should we or should we not? That eventually led us to figure out that, okay, everything we do has to be relevant to helping business leaders to better achieve their goals. And specifically their goals when it relates to their individual performance, well-being, as it relates to their team's performance and their team's alignment, and as it relates to their business growth, innovation, and impact. So the self, the team, and the world that we're looking to serve. And we also wanted to make sure that there's a clear how-to in each conversation. So each conversation should allow everyone in the audience to better know how to be better at something when it comes to achieving their goals, whether by managing themselves better, elevating their team better, or providing a better service and product for their customers in an ever-changing world. So that little conversation, building on the back of years and years of hard effort, but that was like 15, 20 minutes. When that became clear, it helped us scale from that one a month to 20 a month. And it gave clarity to what we want to produce. And then even before we were doing digital events, Ivy itself started with one event in New York City. Like, that was just the first event. And then it became an event a month. Then it became two events a month with different formats, speakers, socials. And then over time, arts and culture events and this. And then now let's do one event a month in DC and one in Boston. And then they became two events a month. Eventually, it scaled to 8 cities with 1,000 events a year across all of them, with travel and formats and stuff like that. But ultimately, it was all working off of the same ethos, which is we want to bring together inspired individuals who want to create a better world, and we want to provide them experiences that help them learn, that help them connect, and that help them to elevate their positive impact on the world by changing their behaviors and collaborating with each other. So because we had that clarity and we figured out how to get people to RSVP to an event and then have a great time at an event and then come back, hopefully referring their friends, it just scaled up so much. So I would say, based on this experience share, what if I could go back and tell my younger self before starting Ivy some guidance, it really is like, what's the formula? What's the E equals MC squared of the content calendar that you're creating, right? And making it modular rather than thinking, if I had started with, okay, we want to do 1,000 events a year, that would have been like crazy daunting. But it was easier to say, yeah, like if it's one event a month, we could do it in 8 cities, and with the same small team, we could probably even travel, and we did, to all of the cities to do one, and then we can start doing more and more as we go. Similarly with the interviews, only once they became good did we actually scale them up in quantity, because we had confidence that the quality would be good. And then in this podcast, now we're trying to figure out how to best do this. And we're starting out once a week with a particular approach. And I'm confident that in a few weeks, it will really settle into like a format that can be scaled further and applied in different ways and so forth. I just think that even though we were never a media company per se, somehow we operated like one successfully, maybe out of naivety of how membership organizations are supposed to function. But because we didn't have a building for our membership, we had to think like a media company in how we operated, because we had to create a content calendar that wasn't just, oh, that sounds good. It was very external facing. If it sounded crappy, nobody would show up. So we had to be really good at make it sound exciting. And then when people are there, make sure it's exciting and valuable, because otherwise no one's going to come back for it. So having that discipline bar of, are people actually engaging with it? Are they honestly finding it valuable? And then how do we perfect that with one format and then maybe expand the formats? And of course, many companies might think we manufacture this thing or we have this service that people come to our branches for. They may not think, oh, content marketing is just not as natural to us. But the reality is, whatever your product or service is, you have something critical to teach the world based on your learnings above and beyond the products and services you deliver directly. What are you learning that you can share with the world that helps them achieve their goals better? And then creating some content around that and maybe not blowing it out of proportion in terms of complexity, just starting quite simply so that above and beyond everything you offer, products and service, you're also offering knowledge and content that also better helps people achieve their goals. And if you help them with that, it's much more likely that they'll then, with that trust that you've built with them, they're going to want to engage with other things that you have to offer. So that's what came up for me on this one, Vidal. What about you?
Well, I'm really thankful that you figured out that formula, and I've been a great beneficiary of it before I worked with Ivy, but just being part of the Ivy community and all those events and seeing that cycle as it expanded, including launching in London with new formats that then expanded and informed future programming. It's really incredible, and it's been a wonderful journey. And I think we should reflect, in terms of choosing joy, we should reflect on how privileged we are to be as brothers talking on this podcast now on a Sunday evening about these wonderful topics, and how privileged we are to learn from incredible individuals like Robert, Julia, Anne, Francis, Kirsten, and getting to talk to them, learn from them, and then teach and share their wisdom with other groups and pay it forward. I think there's a huge one-to-many impact on that. So it is a really great privilege. So I'm choosing joy massively as it comes to Sunday evening, and it's energizing me to have a nice evening and start Monday fresh and really dive into what we do. In terms of Robert's content, I just like this quote that he had, which is, content marketing is about teaching people how to be customers, not just informing them about a product. And it made me reflect on my favorite brand, and I'm not sure if many people know this story. I think they know the brand, certainly. It's Patagonia. But Patagonia, I'm going to say, you can read the founder Yvan Chouinard's book. It's called Let My People Go Surfing. He has a policy that if it's a good day and the waves are good, that work is canceled and people should go surfing. And when it's a snow day or powder day, they got to go skiing. Like, you're not allowed to work on those days. But that's the theme of the book. However, from a marketing perspective, so Yvan didn't like mass consumerism. It was just like not the kind of value system that he had. But Patagonia was having this real peak in the 90s where they were selling like crazy. It was very popular. It was expensive. It was called Patagucci. And he hated this. It wasn't deliberate. Like, it was just happening, but he wasn't trying. He was just trying to make really high quality technical products that were sustainable, that would last a lifetime. So he really didn't want people to buy more stuff. And one Black Friday, I'm not remembering what year this happened, but he didn't like the concept of Black Friday. He said, oh, like Black Friday, everyone does discounts, people buy stuff they don't need. I don't want to do a Black Friday sale. So he made it, he was like, we're not participating in Black Friday as an organization. Then he insisted to his marketing team, we're going to run a full page ad in the New York Times on Black Friday, showing one of our jackets. And the headline of the ad is going to be, do not buy this jacket. And underneath, we're going to tell people all the reasons why they shouldn't buy a new jacket and give them tips on how they can repair their existing jackets. And we're going to give away free repair kits for zippers and so on, like the most common reasons that people would buy a new jacket. And he thought, like, this was not some genius marketing ploy. He was really didn't want people to buy the jacket. And his marketing team were ripping their hair out. They're like, oh, what are you doing? Because, oh, we can't do that. turned out to be the single biggest day of sales at full price, no discounts, on Black Friday in Patagonia's history. And you know what? Yvon Chouinard was not happy about this. He was tearing his hair out as well afterwards because he said, that's not what I was going for. I'm trying to get a message across. I'm trying to inform our customers of how to be our customer, because he really wanted people to believe in reuse, recycle, and repair. Repair first. What was the order? Repair, reuse, and recycle is like the final thing. So interestingly, after this, he told his sales team, I want sales to be lower next year than they are this year. That the growth goal is shrinking. I want it to be lower. So anyway, interesting boss to have. I don't know if a lot of leaders can necessarily reflect on this. The reason I bring it up is because that ethos has really permeated into the kind of core Patagonia consumer, where they will continue to buy Patagonia items, but the brand is doing everything they can to discourage it. They're giving out free repair kits. They're pricing it highly. They're using expensive materials. They're doing everything that they can so that things last a long time and their consumers don't buy more stuff. Their consumers continue to buy more stuff. However, I think Yvon has stabilized the growth in a place that he's comfortable with. But I think this is just such an interesting example, because we at Ivy, while we were never a media company, we're certainly producing content. So whether that's in-person content or digital content or learning content, whatever it might be. So we can think more like a media company. But when you're a brand that's producing clothing, outdoor clothing, there's still content marketing to be done. And there is this process of informing your customer on how to be your customer and how to think like your customer. And it's so crucial. And I think that New York Times Black Friday ad of "do not buy this jacket," despite seemingly being a stroke of absolute marketing genius, was never intended to be. It was really intended to inform their customers, that core group of customers, yeah, really, don't buy this. So I find that really fascinating. I always think about that. And I think the purity of having that ethos and not ever, like, it's their North Star, it's their pure ethos, and they don't ever compromise on this. So the outcomes, whether it's good or bad, they'll live with. And on their side, I think the purity of their ethos is what, it's not... It's not the fact that, like, people are some kind of reverse psychology. It's the purity of their ethos that has sustained them as a brand and has made them so trustworthy to their consumers. And I have to say, I've drank that Kool-Aid, but I don't believe it's Kool-Aid. I know it's genuine. Nobody's BSing me. No one's manipulating me. I know that's the true belief of Yvon, the founder, and the entire team that he's built around him. And so therefore, it's this brand that I intrinsically trust. And I think having that purity in your messaging and your content and every kind of message that comes out of your organization externally is so important, because you're also sharing, we talked about internal energy so much, but the external energy that you share to the wider world, to your consumers, and the impact that you're trying to have is so crucial. So I highly recommend learning from Robert on how you can apply this within your own organization. And I also highly recommend looking at Patagonia as a case study in general, because there's a lot to learn for everyone in that particular case study.
Brilliant. Put Vidal, thank you so much. And thank you everybody for engaging with us this week. All five of these modules are fully available to you now on ivy.com. And going forward, we're going to be sharing an introduction to one new thought leader every single day, together with their life-changing insights that you can check out. So highly recommend that you dive deeper in anything that we share today. We take all of the learnings and we turn them into 10 insights for everybody to dive into at their own convenience. We also are always here to support you. So if you have any very specific learning, development, growth, coaching, challenges, opportunities, whatever will help you and your team better achieve your goals, feel free to reach out to us, and we're very happy to recommend which Ivy modules could help you the most and how you can create those spaces and containers for you to take better action on these. So thank you again for joining us this week. I'm super grateful. And Vidal, last word to you. What's your final call to action to the audience?
A final call to action from the audience is take these learnings and try to apply it. Just try things. I think it's so crucial. And realize that as we started with move fast and fix things, it only takes a week. And if God was able to create the entire universe in a week, then we can certainly find the root causes of our problems and find solutions to them in a short week. Another call to action is, we say, get in touch with us, but truly, we'd love to hear from you. from those listening. And we'd love to help you with whatever problems that you're facing as well. So if you want to reach us, I'll put our email addresses in the notes, but it's barry@ivy.com and vidal@ivy.com. Nice and easy. We'd love to hear from you, any feedback you have, even if it's just to say, you're doing a great job, keep going. Or if it's more constructive feedback, we love that too, because we want to do the best that we can and put out the best product for you. So thank you so much. I'm also super grateful. And Barry, I'll talk to you tomorrow when we're back at work. But for now, we'll enjoy the rest of our Sundays and wishing everyone well.
Thank you, Vidal. Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.